You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Crystal Thomas. Crystal, it's good to have you here today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Glad you could join us.
Sure.
So the way we start this is with a big question, and you just take it how you want to. Who are you? What do we need to know about you to start this conversation?
Oh, that's a great question. I love that question. I am Crystal Venice Thomas, born and raised in Miami, Florida. I am a woman who is very determined in life, but still trying to figure it out.
You're fully engaged, fully present and accounted for.
Fully present and accounted for, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm in Ithaca because I'm a graduate of Cornell, and I like coming back to see folks and go down nostalgia lane, basically.
So what is the nature of your determination? What are you fully present to?
To maximizing life, which involves a number of things, including opportunities, pleasure and fulfillment, love, I guess.
You say that with a curious look on your face.
I mean, you know, I haven't had 100% of that yet. So it's just like, but you know, that's on the list.
You haven't hit the fulfill button.
Not there completely yet. But I mean, you know, a theme that I live by often is be intentional. So when I say I'm determined, it could be whatever's in that moment, right? I try to be intentional about everything I do.
So you brought some music. So what should we open the show with? What should we start with?
Probably Whitney. A little bit of Whitney.
Okay, yeah. Here we go. I want to dance with somebody.
That's it. Yeah.
Here we go. Yeah. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Crystal Thomas. Hey. So, Crystal, given the life you lead now, and you are all, can I say your age on here?
Is sure.
That totally
yeah.
inappropriate? Or, no, okay, so fine. You're in your early 30s, yeah. And you did your degree at Cornell. In the life you have come to live, looking back on where you started from, what did you learn? How do you come to value this life, and how do you come to know how to live it?
That's a big question.
Yeah, it is a big Eric. Question. So in other words, what are the things that help to shape what you're proud of now in your life? What you feel is working for you?
Yeah, a lot. I think I've had different segments of my life. I think, sure. You know, I grew up in South Florida in Miami. And, you know, what I guess you would call the projects, right? And then, you know, that's my early childhood. And then I had the opportunity to, at the time I wanted to be a lawyer growing up. And mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to work summers and winters and after school for this law firm. So then I'm introduced to this new world of intellectuals and, you know, New York lawyers who live in Florida
professional
now.
Class folk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And a number of experiences that I couldn't have imagined. Like even I remember the first time I ate at Capitol Grill. Like that was a big deal. I was like, oh my God, I'm at this high ritzy steakhouse. So, you know, that was one segment of my life where I started to transition into, okay, there's more.
Right.
And then, you know, you have high school where you're working a lot of jobs. And I know, I mean, I feel like I'm answering the question in different waves, yeah. But I'm just thinking of my life into segments. And high school, as you're kind of transitioning into adulthood and responsibility, mm-hmm. I was on the track team and I had like 3 jobs. And then Cornell, which is completely different. This right. Miami girl going to Ithaca, New York, introduced to people who had never even heard Spanish words before in right. life. You right. know, so I think each segment of my life has contributed to different ways I value life mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. The different perspectives that I have about how to live it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So from those, what were some of the lessons from some of those segments that stand
right,
out to you
that
today?
That was the question. Yeah. The biggest thing for me was if I wanted to, I talked about being intentional.
Sure.
I've always had something that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I guess through those different segments, I learned that had I not raised my hand, I wouldn't have made it to that next section, right? So when I wanted to be a lawyer, for example, mm-hmm. I spoke that out into the world and my mom...
And people responded.
Right. Like my mom's, one of her close friends was a legal assistant in an office and she was like, well, why don't you just come and meet Gary and see if this is someplace she wants to be. He took to me and I ended up, you know, even now, you know, that family and another family, Bruce, they became my mentors and kind of an extended mm-hmm. family, and they're still very much a part of my life since I was 12 years old.
Right, right. And your mom knew enough to support you or at least not get in your way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was an only child and my mom was really young when she had me. She was 19. So we were very close growing up and she was learning too as
right.
I was growing.
Right,
so
yeah.
When you have a relationship that's that close, and not only that, but she wanted to give me opportunities that she didn't have mm-hmm. Growing up with a mother who wasn't always there. And so she was raised by her great grandmother, who's, you know, born in 1897 or so. So
right.
You imagine very traditional old school black family. There were chickens running around, you know, so she grew up in a very disciplined household. But, you know, not a lot of money. And
right,
we didn't
right.
have money growing up initially either. And my mom really wanted to do all that she could to provide for me. And she did. So any opportunity she saw, she let me run at it.
Right, right, right. And I think in some ways, if you don't have money, you get better at seeing opportunity.
Oh, totally.
Because
yeah.
opportunity doesn't always have to have but come by money.
Yeah, exactly.
And when you were talking about being intentional, how did that discipline of scanning the environment for opportunities, how did that develop in you?
Yeah, you know, you gotta make, what do they say, make lemon, if you can
if
make
you get
lemon,
lemons, you gotta
yeah,
make
you
lemonade.
Can make lemonade. So you take what you got and you can make something more out of it. And, you know, you could say on both sides, because I didn't have a lot, my imagination was very vast. So,
right.
Whereas I had peers who they couldn't imagine more, you know, because they always got what they wanted. So there wasn't a great sense of imagination because they had the access. So for me, I'll give you an example.
Sure.
When it came around to take SATs, that's one of those things where you see, I had the fortune of getting into a magnet school. So there are people from different socioeconomic backgrounds in my high school, different ethnicities as well. You know, it was a pretty diverse school. Mm-hmm. But you got a lot of these kids doing college prep classes, and they were really expensive. And so for me, it's like, okay, do I rely on my own just intellect and wit to pass these SATs by myself? Or how can I get in one of these college prep classes? I can't afford them. So I went to one of the offices and I talked to the lady who worked at this college prep school or program.
Right.
And I asked her, how can I be involved in this? Is there some type of aid? Is there anything? And she asked me if I wanted to just come work there and I could take the classes for free. So, you know, that was always something I did. Even when I went to Cornell, the bursar's office was my second home, because you couldn't tell me that there wasn't a way I can get as much money as possible. So I don't get, what do I qualify for? What can we do? What do we need to talk about? What can we move around?
Right.
I always ask questions.
Right.
So I think, you know, that's how I don't know. I just.
Do you remember, were you always one to ask questions from your earliest
Okay. I was. That got me in trouble sometimes. I asked too many questions and I always wanted to have the last word.
Right.
And that got me, I was beat as a child, so that was spanked, as you say.
Yeah.
And that was usually why.
Uh-huh.
Questioning, you know, adults are always right. So don't.
You weren't
question
spanked
them.
For the questions. You were spanked for the challenge.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's an authority thing, which is, you know, on some level, you got to know where to pull back.
Yeah,
and
of course.
Where to push. But if you persisted in asking questions, that means somebody listened to you really early on. Who listened to your questions and took you seriously enough that you didn't give up? Because a lot of kids start with questions, but they give up when nobody bothers to answer them or take them seriously.
Yeah. I think my mom definitely listened to my questions.
Was young, so she's probably kind of enjoying it.
And she was trying to figure it out too, because I think what she realized was there were a lot of questions that she couldn't answer. And so what ended up happening is, you know, I'm in school and I ask a lot of questions and my mom put me first. You know, I'll give you another example. Growing up, when you're a black kid and you're, you know, running around a school, they don't automatically think you're necessarily smart. They think that maybe you have an attention deficit problem.
Right.
So when I was young, and that's not limited to black kids, of course, when I was young, you know, in first grade, there was a meeting and the teacher brought in my mom and said, hey, we think we need to put Crystal on Ritalin or something like that. And my mom was like, are you out of your mind? Don't you ever tell a black woman to put her child on Ritalin, you know? And it turns out that I was disruptive and running around and bothering the other kids because I finished my work early.
Right.
And I didn't have anything to do.
Right.
So then I went from that. So because of those types of things and like telling my mom, like, I'm bored.
Yeah.
She started to ask questions. And then I ended up in gifted the next year. So, you know, I had to change schools.
Right.
And so my mom started to ask questions I'd say she was my first listener, where maybe I didn't know how to articulate the questions just right, but she knew to dig enough a bit more.
Yeah.
And you
drew the advocate out of her.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I was her only child, that wasn't hard to do, I'd say.
Yeah, but we often don't think of it that way. And many times the kids put the parents in the position of growing up. In that sort of way.
Yeah.
And that happens for older adults too.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't think it does, then you don't understand the power of a child's inquisitiveness.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad she listened.
Yeah.
And I'd say, you know, once I worked at that law firm, I asked a lot of questions that, you know, my mom didn't have the answers to, that the lawyers were able to answer. Lawyers, then mentors, family, Gary and Bruce, you know, answer. I mean, even teach me how to eat properly at a table, you know, the forks and, you know, the proper etiquette behind that, which I later learned at Cornell again.
You got to learn. And I went to Columbia as an exchange student. I was still picking my nose and my teeth and I didn't know how to eat properly at a table. And my Colombian mother said, you're going to go to school in the morning, and then at lunch, you're going to stay home, and I'm going to teach you manners and etiquette.
Yep.
Because you need it.
Yeah.
And it was, I could have taken it as a great insult. It wasn't. It was a great gift.
Yeah. And it's not something people think about. Okay, this is where the fork goes. This is where, come on.
Well, if you come from a middle class or better background, that's expected.
Mm-hmm.
You never even learn it because it's just the only thing you know.
Yeah.
But if you never learned it, you got to learn it.
Exactly. So,
let's cut to music again.
Sure.
What should we play next? We've got your list here.
That's good. Yeah. Let's do. Oh, I think I might have. Yeah, let's do Part of Your World. That's a good one.
Okay, good. And that actually fits with the time zone we were looking at.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Here we go.
See how a world that makes such wonderful things could be bad. Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete? Wouldn't you think I'm the girl who has everything? Look at this trove, treasures untold. How many wonders can one cavern hold? Looking around here, you think, sure, she's got everything. I've got gadgets and gizmos aplenty. I've got who's it's and what's it's galore. You want thingamabobs? I got 20. But who cares? No big deal. I want more. I want to be where the people are. I want to see, them dancing, walking around on those, what do you call them? Oh, feet. Flipping your fins, you don't get too far. Legs are required for jumping, dancing, strolling along down a, what's that word again? Street. Up where they walk, up where they run, up where they stay all day in the sun, wandering free. Wish I could be part of that world. What would I give if I could live out of these waters? What would I pay to spend a day warm on the sand? Betcha on land they understand that they don't reprimand their daughters. Bright young women, sick of swimming, ready to stand and ready to know what the people know. Ask them my questions and get some answers. What's a fire and why does it, what's the word, burn? When's it my turn?
Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Crystal Thomas.
Hey.
So, Crystal, when you were looking out at that world from the projects or that first school before you got into the gifted program, and now you've been out of that world for 25 years, or 20.
Oh, gosh.
At least that piece of it. It's a slow movement out. You know, it's going to college, and then it's going to work and whatnot. But What has been as good or better than you thought it would be, and what has not been what you hoped it would be?
It's definitely been good to have a broader perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And this I've gotten not only after going to college and things, but I mean, you know this, but for the last 3 years I've spent living in Belgium, mm-hmm. in Europe. And there's just, speaking of the world, there's the world is so much bigger than us. And often, and you see this a lot today in the current kind of element that we're in, whether it's political or otherwise, where people stay in their bubble. And I could have easily, if I didn't ask questions and if I didn't have that desire to kind of see beyond, stayed in that bubble.
Sure.
And when I go home now, there are still people that I know from that time that are still doing the same things and still thinking the same things. And for me, the perspective has been even more than I thought it would be. The perspective and the knowledge that I gained, mm-hmm. connecting with people from different cultures and places in me than where I've from, and then understanding them and mm-hmm. empathizing.
When you empathize, it's almost like you can be in their skin just a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can only empathize once you truly understand what it means to be in their skin or to understand what they might be going through or their perspective on things. And so that's been amazing. You know, I've lived in several different cities and states, and having that perspective, exploring the world has been everything to
me.
And it shaped a lot of who I am and how I feel about things.
You have the curiosity, which kind of throws you into the learning moment.
Yeah.
But you also have to let other people lead you through what you need to know.
Oh, of course. Totally.
And when we come out of situations that are limited for whatever reason,
yeah.
we often come out of it with a tremendous amount of energy and force, and learning how to balance being led.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's hard for me sometimes. I mean, you know, I'm not that I'm hard to lead, but you know, I do ask a lot of questions and you know,
and people give you their leadership by answering your questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not a dependent sort of thing.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
But I kind of sidetracked this. What about leaving the space you were from did not satisfy you in the way that you thought it would, or was there anything that was disappointing?
You know, it's a hard question to answer, but I'd say there's a sense of community that you experience that I don't know that I've found in other places. You know, growing up in a very small community where a lot of things are relatable, right?
Right,
Whether it's, you know, economically, financially, and the support that you give each other. And growing up in the church as well, there's a grounding that's mm-hmm. there that, you know, sometimes we can lose part of ourselves when we see this bigger world and the access that we can have access to. And I think for me, it was important to stay grounded, and I lost that sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So in other places, you know, particularly when you come to places like Cornell, and then when I moved to New York City, you miss people coming to check you every now and then, like,
right.
Hey, you know, this is where you're from. This is what life really is. And I think I missed that a bit.
Right, right. And it, you're tying it a little bit to shared history. Mm. You're tying it more to just a checking in on what's the context of your life. What does the big picture look like? And how are you doing with a big open question where people know how to read your body language and your stuff where you don't have to explain it all to them.
Yeah, I mean, there's that too, right? And we get that from companionship, from friends, from family. Yeah. But sometimes when you leave long enough, even those closest to you may not know who you are anymore.
Right, right. And so it's something that is what I'm kind of getting around. It's something that gets cultivated.
Mm.
And what I have seen is that people, even if they come from strong communities, but they want more,
mm-hmm.
they're pushing away from it, and they don't start trying to recover it until sometime in their 30s or maybe their early 40s, when it becomes something that is both worth seeking, and they begin to have the skills to seek it.
That's true.
So
that's a good point, actually, because I'm finding myself in that mode, trying to find that context.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we were talking about it a bit earlier, and how as we get older and situations amongst friends and family become more serious, how do you deal with those things, like, you know, death and extended families, right. and you start to seek a support system to help you through some of that stuff. And I don't know that I would have been able to go back to much of that when I was in my
20s. No. Yeah. Right. You're still pushing for your place.
Yes.
And that's appropriate.
Yeah.
That's appropriate. I'm curious. Sure. You had such intensity about doing the law thing, and you started so young, and you went through a high school program that would have got you launched in that direction.
Yep.
And then you didn't do it at all. How did that happen?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's a story of my life. I wanted to be a lawyer for as long as I can remember, up until I was about 16 or 17 years old. I was a junior in high school. I was working at this law firm every day, and I was also part of the legal program, which is what you're alluding to, in high school. And then one day I was standing in Gary's office, who was one of the partners at the law firm, and he was like, "Oh, you don't need to be a lawyer. You shouldn't be a lawyer. You got too much personality to be a lawyer. Go and be on TV. Go be Oprah. Go do something else." And I was like, "You're right." I was so, what I was drawn to with law was, and you still see this, the idea of being in front of people and pleading my case. In the same way that I ask a lot of questions, I also have conviction when I feel a certain way about things, and I will, and this got me in trouble as a child too. Why not? Why? I think I'm right until I realize I'm wrong. And so, that was not the reality of law. I was doing a lot of research. I was typing up depositions. I was sitting in small rooms with judges. And, you know, that wasn't the life that I saw.
Sure.
And so that was the first time in my life, and I just experienced it recently, where I had everything so planned, and then it just felt like everything fell apart because I had never thought of an alternative.
Right.
I didn't know what it was to not want to be a lawyer. And now I'm in high school and I have to apply for colleges and tell them what I want to do with my life. I had no idea. But yeah, that's how it happened.
Right. But what's really neat is that you had a major failure in the sense of what you thought you wanted wasn't what you wanted.
Oh, that was a big deal.
Before you went to college.
Yep.
And people who don't have that major failure until they're out in the workforce, they oftentimes don't have a much harder time recovering from it. But it also seems the way you tell the story, it's the person who delivered the verdict, so to speak.
Yeah.
Was your mentor who you loved.
Yep.
But you knew yourself as well as he did.
Yep.
That wasn't going
to
work.
I mean, you're right. But I needed him to tell me.
And that's just incredible.
Yeah. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. And you took it. And what further as a kid from, as a kid having to kind of come up from the bottom, you had a sense that you could make a choice about your life rather than take whatever you stumbled into.
Oh yeah.
I did not have that sense.
Wow.
Because for me, just getting out was the challenge.
Mm.
And everything, it didn't matter to a certain extent where I got to. I just had to get out.
My mom gave me that confidence and that idea that I always had a choice. And even when she said, and you'll see this on TV and you hear it said, but I can tell you that every black little girl, for the most part, has been told by their mom that you have to work twice as hard because you're a woman and you're black.
Right.
And so I took that to heart, and you know, still to this day, I find that to be true. And, you know, that made me think, you know what, if I don't want to do this, I want to do something else. Because if I'm going to work twice as hard at something,
you wanna like
then
it?
I want it to be something I want to be doing.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the logic that I took and applied to it.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. But I mean, that's a good point. Yeah.
So let's take another music break. What should we play next?
You know, I was thinking about this a few moments ago. This Something Is Missing song by Brandy.
Okay.
I think that's good.
Here we go.
Boom, clap, boom, clap, boom, clap, boom, clap, boom, clap, boom, clap, clap. I'm feeling such a vacancy, clap, I don't feel whole.
Clap,
boom, wish clap, I can put my finger on it, clap, but I don't boom, know clap, what it is. Looked in every place I could see,
clap,
trying to find
clap,
a missing part
clap,
of me.
Clap,
Listening to the Made of Clay Report, and our guest is Crystal Thomas. So, Crystal, something is missing. I know when you came to Cornell, you came to the College of Arts and Sciences, and you didn't go to the hotel school.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, how did that transition happen? But maybe even on a bigger picture, what worked for you at Cornell and what didn't?
So first question, yeah, something is missing. So that was a part of my life. Didn't want to be a lawyer, going to college. First time I don't know what I want to do. And I felt like I was going in circles trying to find what it is I wanted to fulfill me. And so I started out in the arts and sciences school, which I figured had the most breadth of opportunity if I want to figure out a few things. Thought I'd be an econ major, did well, hated it. And I just started to talk to people. And, you know, you think of this idea of, oh, I'll go into business, whatever that means.
Right.
And I heard about the AIM school and I heard about the hotel school. And if I'm being completely honest, sorry, hotelies out there. But I was thinking the hotel school because there wasn't a science requirement in the college. So the AIM school had like bio and I was like, nope, not doing that. Hotel school sounds fun. I had never heard of it, but I have to say I took, shout out to Renita McCarthy. I took the hotel ops class because you needed to take a class before you could internally transfer. And I fell in love with the idea of hotels and travel, and it just opened up this world that I never thought of before. And I started the process of transferring internally.
Sure.
Which was the best decision I'd ever made.
What year did you transfer?
I transferred, funny story, I got rejected my first time applying to transfer internally. It was my fall semester of my sophomore year, so that would have been 2005. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to try again. Let's see what happens. And there's a department dedicated to internal transfers.
Sure.
And she was like, not normal for people to apply twice. And I was like, okay, well, I'm not normal. So, but I mean, ultimately I got in the second time, which was great. But
she who laughs lasts.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, so that was how that happened. And the second question was what worked and what didn't.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, cause we're, you know, we're coming, you're a first generation college student.
Yeah.
and you're coming to Cornell as African-American woman, you know, what, and this is not the best environment. I mean, not that there's a great environment, but there, what are the, what worked well for you and what didn't work so well?
Well, what worked well was that I was far away from everyone from Florida. I think that was good for me, and I wanted to get away. So I was in this new community of people. And although, you know, the Black community is very small, but very connected at Cornell, we had a number of, events and groups that were great. And one of the first things I did, I became the director of the gospel choir here. So that was huge for me. And I was able to maintain some type of continuity with my faith and my singing and things like that within this really great community that I grew to love. And then I was on the track team, which was a big part of my life as well. So again, continuity. I've been an athlete all my life, and I've been a part of successful programs, and Cornell has one of the best.
Continuity and community.
I said those.
So
those two things were huge in my adjustment here. What didn't work as well, you know, I don't know. I really loved it here. You know, people ask me about Cornell and they're like, oh, it was Ithaca. It wasn't. I was like, it was awesome. So I'm not sure a lot of things didn't work. I mean,
no, and that's,
Do
you, and you had a lot of jobs.
I worked a lot.
Yeah.
I can't function if I'm not super busy. So I always went, if I have too much space in between things, I become lazy and I can't get anything done. So my schedule is wake up, class, study, job, track, job, study, and repeat, you know?
Right.
So that was...
And you lived on campus most of the time?
First year I lived on campus. Second year I was an RA on campus. Third year I lived off campus with two of my friends from track. And my last year I lived alone off campus. So I had every experience, I think. For the most part.
I mean, what's really neat is you made it work for you.
And
I think people who get stuck are either those who can't make it work for them, or it's just something doesn't.
It's funny that you say that. That is something I used to say almost exactly to students, to peers. I was a one of those coaches here in Day Hall, so I would help people with their resumes and careers. And people would ask about being in a place like Cornell, like you did. Well, isn't it hard? Isn't it, you know, it's big, it's small, whatever your perspective is. And I said, look, Cornell is a place, well, if you want to make it work, you can make it work. And you need to put the effort in, find those things that you want to do, particularly in a place like the hotel school, where people make fun of it, that it's kind of like a high school, because you could spend all of your time in that one building.
Right.
But if you don't seek out things outside of it, of course you're not going to make the most of the university. So for me, I had to make the most of it, and Cornell allowed you to do that.
Right. And there are things about that. When I was in my doctoral program, the place you wanted to go to get data management and data presentation skills was the hotel school.
Oh yeah.
It was the best place on campus. Oh
yeah.
And
that's one of the first classes you take.
So I'm reflecting on part of, and this is not this is not about me, but it connects to, I came with from a very mediocre school. I wasn't even in the top 10% of a class of 42 students. But I fulfilled a distribution requirement in the arts college at Cornell, but I had a great first semester. We got to be a college scholar. So I got freed of all the distribution and major requirements. And I was smart one-on-one. But I didn't have the study skills that you would have learned in a magnet school or whatever. Once I got dumped into those large courses, things fell apart.
Oh.
And I'd also run for the university senate, which managed the non-academic budget of the university in those days. And they disbanded at the end of my freshman year. And so that left me without my people, my posse.
Okay.
And I did not understand what had happened until I was far enough down. So I took a leave of absence rather than to try to live with college students for a year while I watched them do what I didn't know how to do.
Oh, wow.
And I worked construction
that
year, and I lived in an apartment with students, and I got to see how they coped because I couldn't do it.
Huh.
And I learned and developed a little confidence, because as my skill level went up, my confidence went up.
Yeah.
And finished fine. But it was just... it was a different experience, but you came fully loaded to make it your own.
Yeah. I mean, I had to.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me, it was just no other choice. I'm here.
Yeah.
So do what you got to do, girl. Keep right. going.
Well, I mean, but it's also, that's your personality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my personality totally. Was more pensive. And the ambition was more of a facade for me because I needed it to get out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It wasn't. Yeah. I am ambitious, but not in that way.
Well, I wasn't saying you weren't.
No.
Well, you know what's funny? When I was in high school, I didn't apply for any Florida schools. And that was intentional. I knew I did not want to go. I did not want to go to school in Florida, so I didn't see the point. And my guidance counselors thought I was crazy because being from Florida, we had this thing called the Bright Futures Program where you could go to school for free. It was funded by the lottery if you had, like, you know, a minimum of these academic scores, which I was already far and above, and so I would have gotten full rides, but I didn't want to be in Florida, so I didn't apply. And my guidance counselors, even up until the last moment, were like, maybe you should just fill out the common application and just in case. And I was like, no, I want to go to Cornell. That's what I'm going to do. And, you know, and I say that because I adjusted. Look, Cornell was nothing like high school, right? I thought, in high school, I didn't study for anything. I could study right before and, you know, it was fine. I tried to do that my first semester at Cornell. Like, oh, I'll do the last minute. And I was like, oh my God, this is not high school. So, you know, speaking about adjusting, I didn't come in with, you know, everything already ready to go. But, you know, I don't know. I became kind of a chameleon to try to make it work. Exactly. Yeah, cool. So anyway.
What did you... You went from the hotel school to work in the hotel industry?
Yep, I did.
And branding has been a big part of your career?
It has, for the majority now. Yeah.
And so what does that entail?
Branding?
Yeah.
Well, it's basically creating a voice and an image of something and making other people understand it and believe in it too.
Right. Or making it, you make it so that it is so immediately understandable that there's almost no work.
Well, that's the intention, yeah. You know, because you want people or a certain segment of people, you know, you can't be all things to all people, right? So you want a certain segment of people to identify with your brand.
And get it quickly.
So,
and you made some kind of, it was kind of, you could go into business comment about when you were being a econ major.
Right.
Well, actually, you gone into business in a kind of a big way.
Yeah.
Especially in terms of the branding pieces, which how as a business is known and how it's kind of handled by the public.
Yeah.
What do you see as your next steps?
That's a great question. So if I could just repeat one, I feel like my life goes in cycles because things keep happening. So even going into business, I thought after I joined the hotel school, I was not going to work for hotels. I'm like, I'll take this degree and go and work in business somewhere. Yep. But again, hotels happened. But once I realized I did want to work in hotels, I wanted to be in sales. Me, my goal was to be, I can sell anything and I'm good at it. I like talking. I like selling stuff. This is going to be my career. I'm going to be a director of sales somewhere. Man, I did that for a year and a half and I was like, I do not want to do this. But I don't know what I want to do.
Be careful what you ask for.
I know. It was insane. I'm like, is this happening again? Is this my lawyer moment?
Yeah.
And I got into branding and that was where I belonged. And I got into that by making like this pro-con list. And there's always a person. And for me, her name was Marianne McNulty. And she was the recruiter, the college recruiter for Starwood, the company I ended up working for at the time. And she was like, look, you don't have to do sales. Just write down a list of stuff that you like doing and stuff that you don't. So I did that. I showed it to her. She was like, this sounds like branding. I said, what's that? And I started just kind of looking into that. So I set that foundation to say that as far as my next steps, I'm working on my pro-con list again, because that's an exercise that worked for me. And if I were to stay in this realm of in this industry, I think branding, brand marketing is something that I do well and that I love doing. But the element of branding that I love the most is really the culture and the training elements of it. So meaning imparting my passion for things into other people and rallying people behind things that I care about and brands that I like. I love that. I love making you feel like you can identify with me or with the thing that I'm so passionate about. And so if I can do that in a different capacity, I'd be happy to do that. If I could be in front of a stage in front of a bunch of people, I'd be happy to do that too, as long as I'm talking about something that I care about.
You've talked about, I mean, you can pull that off in politics. You can pull that off in religion. You can pull that off in entertainment.
Yeah.
All three of those places need that kind of personal presence, clarity of vision, clarity of expression that people understand and can adapt to themselves so that it's not a cult. You know, they can make it work for themselves, you know, and they and they can move with it.
Yeah. I mean, look, a lot, I say this jokingly sometimes. My short bio used to say, if fear of failure weren't an option, she'd be Oprah or the next Oprah.
Right.
And I say that in jest, but I mean part the effect that she has on people through things that she believes in is similar to what I'd like to do in any capacity.
So, but let's stay with that painful piece of humor. If fear of failure weren't an option,
right?
But fear of failure is a part of our lives, and where does it get you? How does the fear of failure make you smaller or make you hold back?
Man, it gives me anxiety attacks, first of all, because I'm such a control freak. So I think of the worst possible option, and that just makes me want to do more.
Right.
But, you know, but the fear of failure is something that is very real, like you said. But you learn, you know, when you fail, you learn. And I know that sounds cliche, and it's true,
but I'm going to, I want to push back on this a little bit, if you don't mind my jumping in.
Sure.
I don't know if you're a control freak or if you're a skill junkie. And if you have skills, you're not likely to have anxiety. Now, they may not always be the skills you need, so then you'll freak out because you don't know what you really need to do in this particular moment. But if you feel like you have the skill or you're just one or two notches below achieving that skill, it's always it's a scalable problem.
Right.
But if you feel like you just don't have the skills, then crippling anxiety is a quite possible response.
Well, I think the anxiety comes in with uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that I'm not confident about a skill. It's that, you know, I've set these things in motion and I don't see the end yet, yet. Right. And that's what gives me anxiety because I don't know
what the outcome's going to be.
Exactly.
And that's because it's not just worth doing, because it's worth doing even if you fail miserably.
Yeah. Well,
and that's the other way to kind of frame that problem. And if you can hold on to the fact that I'm going to do this because I here I stand, I can do no other, the Martin Luther line, you know, that's then failure doesn't really matter because I couldn't have avoided it because I had to do this.
Right.
And that's a bet on your life.
It is. I do want to be so passionate about something that's the way I feel.
Yeah.
I have to do this because you never know what's going to happen. No, one life. Don't.
Right. Change gears.
Yeah.
Way I like to close this show, and we need to close out in about 10 minutes.
Okay.
Is to ask, what do you do to take care of yourself emotionally, physically, intellectually, throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly? You know, every once in a while, what do you do to take care of yourself, and how do you know you need to do it?
Connection is very important to me. I'm the person who walks into a room and is energized by the fact that I don't know anyone there, because I'm like, oh my God,
so many people to get to know,
so many new people. Oh my God, I get to talk to all of them. Let's see how long it takes me
to
do it.
That would cause panic attacks in a whole lot of people.
I know. That's why, like, my friends think I'm crazy, but I love that. And I say that to say that the way that I continue to fulfill that need is through connections, even in the smallest way. So picking up the phone and calling somebody and talking on the phone for a bit, or texting for a bit, and just people connections is a way that I'm well sustained. And how do I knew I need to do it? I didn't realize it until I was without it. Like, I lived in Brussels, and that is not the most exciting place to live. But I lived in another country, where English was not the first language. I didn't know anyone there besides my colleagues. I traveled a lot. So I became lonely for the first time in my life. And I didn't know what that meant. And it wasn't until I started to realize the things that weren't as consistent in my life, and that was people, and that was being around people that I connected with, that I realized that that was huge for me to stay sane.
Right.
So I began to connect with people even more, thank God for technology, from, you know, 3,600 miles away because of that. And now that I'm back, it's, I have to, you know, pick up the phone and talk to people. And I know that's a big way of taking care of myself is by doing that. Smaller things. I try to meditate a little bit in the morning. I'm not that successful at it often, but when I do it, it's awesome to really create space and try to make space.
Sure.
And I read. I mean, reading is huge, and I always feel better after doing it.
What sorts of things do you read?
Well, I've been reading, I like nonfiction. So I've been reading a lot of things to try to learn. So, you know, I just read The Year of Yes by Shonda Rhimes a few months ago. I read The New Jim Crow. I've been reading a lot of James Baldwin recently. He's such a great writer. It makes me jealous while I'm reading him. I'm like, how did you put these words together?
And you know, 50, 70 years ago.
And that was a long time ago. So to think of him, and I related to him in some way too, because he had this phase where he moved to Europe and saw America in a different way once he once he did that. So that, but then I just reread A Wrinkle in Time. You know, so I have these moments of like where, and this is why I played A Part of Your World. I love Disney, and like I have this inner child thing that makes me feel really nice inside. And sometimes that's reading an old school storybook. So, yeah, I mean, those things. And I pray a little bit. That makes me feel good. So, yeah.
And you were a state record holder, a national level athlete. So what do you do physically to kind of...
Yeah, so I used to work out a lot, but after, you know, I started working out probably, you know, obviously elementary school, you do a lot of running, but I started working out in the gym from sixth grade all through college, you could imagine, as a varsity athlete, and then afterwards, and I just needed a break. So I stopped working out for a bit, but yeah, I go to the gym. I tried to get into things like yoga, and but again, like meditation, it's hard to keep up with, but you know, I like a good little gym time.
Right.
Yeah, like personal training. I like lifting weights and things, so I do that.
Neat.
Yeah.
What have you learned in your self-care about yourself that you didn't know? You learned about the loneliness and the need for connection.
Yeah.
But have there been other things that you've come to know and accept about yourself that you might not have noticed had you not stepped back?
As far as my self-care, I know that I need to be passionate about something in order to do it, to complete it. And that's something I learned about myself, even within my professional life in the last few years.
So you just can't take on the role and do it. You've got to feel it.
I've got to feel it. And it sounds like it's commonplace, but I know a number of people who could do something that they don't care about.
And do it well.
And I used to think I was capable of that. And I probably am to some on some level, but I don't want to be. I can put out a really good project or do something really great if I'm into it. And if I'm not, it'll suffer and so will I.
Right. And it sounds like, I mean, the way I hear what you're saying is you want your life to be integrated, and so the passion has to be there.
Yeah.
And where I see people really being doing well and not being into stuff is where their lives, their passion is in another part of their life, but they need that particular role in order to make the other part work. That's not a compromise you can make at this point.
I don't think so. And that's why I'm taking a much needed break right now from work, and just to figure out how I can create and keep that balance in my life. Because I know it's important, and I can't thrive without that balance. So,
absolutely,
that was good to learn.
So, what you've learned in terms of the arc after college, about how to start yourself in a career and then step back from it. What do you think people who are coming through the hotel school now should be thinking about in terms of? I used to teach a course, and I asked the students, you know, imagine where you want to be 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. So that would be a little not. You're further than that, or just about
no,
that.
No, I'm
actually
almost at my 10
so
years, yeah.
So what do you need to know about yourself? And what do you, and how you work, how you cause your life to work, mm-hmm. and what do you need to know about the way the world works in order to get there?
Right.
And because what's causality in both of those? What did you need to learn about yourself to know how to push yourself through the various advancements, opportunities you've had to take them, to let go, to accept the, you know, to take the time out after the job in Belgium?
Yeah. You need to know what you bring to the table. And you need to know and understand your value to people, to an organization, to anywhere.
Right. And it's your what you bring compared to other people in the organization, and as well as what you just inherently have. Because a lot of it's,
yeah,
you know, it's, there are two different ways to know what you bring.
Yeah, like I'm not even thinking of in comparison to other people, because some other people might bring a similar or the same thing, but...
But you bring it in a particular way.
Right.
And that's still a comparison.
Yeah. Well, okay.
You know, but okay. So you really know yourself by yeah. knowing where you could fit or where you might not fit.
Yeah. And it's important to know who you are within the context of any organization or group. And what I find is a missed opportunity and a challenge sometimes is when I even observe people who don't know where they fit in. And it's because they don't know who they are yet. Right. And... You know, it's easier to say than do, but it's important that we do that. And that's one thing. Look, I lived in New York City for 5 years and I didn't do a lot of self-reflection. And that's why I was lonely in Brussels.
Right, right.
Because
right.
I didn't really know who I was.
You didn't prepare for that step of life.
Exactly. And right. so if you can do it sooner and really take the moment to draw out the noise, don't listen to it, and just sit there and say, who am I? What am I bringing to this world? What's my value? And what is it that will fulfill me? And knowing that, look, this is what I bring to the table. And if you're not here for it, then
bye. At the end of the day, I need to be out of here.
Exactly. Yeah. And once you know that, then that's it.
Crystal, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Oh, thanks, Eric.
What should we close the show with?
Oh, man, they're both kind of sad songs. So, well, not sad, but let's go with For All We Know. It seems it might feel like a little too much finality, but I think it's a beautiful song.
Okay, and here we go. Thank you.
Yeah.
Never meet again, before you go, make this moment sweet again. We won't say